This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. We are joined today by Congressman Fred Upton. I want to note at the beginning that we are speaking on Friday afternoon. Things have been moving fast in the news, so it seems important to note when we are speaking. Thank you for being
here. Who knows what will happen by Monday?
Right.
And, you know, as you told me, reminded me to turn off my cell phone. You know, I gave a speech a little bit earlier today, and yes, it buzzed a bunch of times and said, well, Fred, maybe it's the president. I said, he doesn't use the phone anymore.
Yeah.
He just opens the window.
There we go. All right. You made a statement following the firing of FBI Director James Comey saying that you would support appointing a special prosecutor at the appropriate time. What would be the appropriate time?
Yeah, so I can do that. At the appropriate time. So I don't know when that time will be, but a couple of things. First of all, we need to get to the bottom of this. It was appropriate, and I think I said so at the time, when Jeff Sessions, the attorney general, recused himself. It was appropriate for the chairman of the House Intel Committee, after some miscues, I think, recused himself as well. Mike Conaway now takes that role. We have two separate investigations that are going on, at least two plus the FBI, between the House and the Senate. As I understand things from afar, because I don't serve on that committee, and of course I've been in, you know, I've been out of Washington now for a week. We're back in session today when this show airs, but you know, a lot of work has been done. They have witnesses. I sense that they've served subpoenas. They're trying to get information. They have they're spending a lot of time with staff and others trying to get to the bottom of this. When you do an independent investigation or an independent counsel, whatever you want to call it, first of all, who is that person, man or woman, going to be? I don't know. You have to generate a lot of staff. You got to go through the whole ethics requirements in terms of disclosure and all of that. You've got to find office space. You then get into a little bit of a cumbersome procedure on immunity. Do we give immunity to so-and-so to spill the beans? You know, who has jurisdiction? All that has to be worked out. And at the meantime, the current investigation, which is bipartisan, House and Senate, could in fact slow down. I want to get the answer as fast as we can. So the appropriate time for me, the way I define it, is if they get stuck, if they're not getting cooperation from a variety of witnesses, maybe just one, maybe someone's taking the fifth, they're not able to get information, and they somewhat say uncle, then it's time to get to, then we need, maybe a stronger baseball bat. But I don't want to stop the current investigation. And because it is, it's top secret, I don't know what the results are. We may have a briefing on it perhaps as early as next week when we come back to find out what happens. But, at the appropriate time, could be as short as a week away, it could be a couple weeks. Let's see what happens.
Is there any reason they couldn't go on concurrently? You could still have a congressional investigation and a special prosecutor.
Though. You then have issues as to who might get immunity and who might not in terms of delaying or letting that investigation go forward. So, I don't know how that would all work. I would need to be walked, and again, I don't know who selects. I mean, that'll be quite the issue. Who is going to select that special counsel? Is it the House? Is it, who is it? Do you work this with the Senate? I don't know the answer to that. It'll be something that I'll be looking to get some answers to when I get back to Washington next week, week as this airs.
Your Republican colleague from Michigan, Justin Amash, has signed on as a co-sponsor of a bill that would appoint a bipartisan independent commission to investigate Russian interference in the 2016 election.
It would
have
to be bipartisan, but you don't want this to be a partisan deal on either side. It would have to be bipartisan. That's a good thing. I don't know whose bill it is.
There's only two Republican co-sponsors, Walter Jones of North Carolina.
Walter Jones. Again, I'm not saying no. I want to be convinced that that is the right approach and that it won't interfere with the current investigations, which, as I understand it, are going okay.
David Frum had a pretty scathing column in The Atlantic after the firing of James Comey. He did say that whether or not there's any wrongdoing here on the part of President Trump deserves withholding of judgment. But he said that we all now must show must take seriously the heightened possibility of guilt, either personal or on the part of people near him, and of guilt of some of the worst imaginable crimes in the political lexicon. He goes on to say that the question has to be asked searchingly of the Republican members of Congress: will you allow a president of your party to attack the integrity of the FBI? For people who might question whether or not an investigation run by Congress, where Republicans have control of both the House and Senate, and we're talking about a Republican president, what do you say to address those concerns?
Well, a couple of things. First, I didn't see the column.
But, it's in the Atlantic.
But we need an independent FBI, and that's why the term is 10 years. It's not, it doesn't go concurrently with a, you know, with a president's, you know, 8 years if they're reelected. They need to be above reproach. They need to be confirmed by the Senate. I was as surprised as anyone when I heard the news last week, you know, when he was axed. But the deed has been done. Didn't need the consult of the Congress to get it done. And I could objectively say that he did lose the confidence of both Republicans and Democrats. In fact, I want to say Hillary Clinton earlier this month, May 2nd, was very, very critical of Comey in terms of why she lost. I've got a, you know, we don't need to get into that. Republicans, you know, particularly when you had the whole Loretta Lynch, Bill Clinton episode on the tarmac in Arizona for a couple hours, raised real questions about, you know, how was this allowed to happen, and where was someone seeking a conscience in terms of that investigation? So, you know, it's you know, it is what it is. Now we got to move forward. Whoever this man or woman will be in terms of the replacement, they have to have the confidence of both Republicans and Democrats. Obviously, have to get through a confirmation. But I, you know, we don't vote on it in the House. I'd like to see the vote 80, 90 votes, maybe even better, versus a 52-48. You know, Mike Rogers from Michigan is one of the names that's on like a list of a dozen, former colleague, former FBI agent. Chaired the House Intelligence Committee for a number of years before he retired. I think he would be an outstanding choice and has great, great respect on the other side, the Democratic side of the aisle.
You did note there, though, that it is unusual for the FBI director to be fired, and
their
10-year terms,
absolutely,
which is supposed to make it so that the president. When it does happen, you know, it happened under President Clinton with William Sessions, but there was a lot of other things going on with William Sessions. Should the president spell out in some sort of concrete way why it was he was fired? Because we've heard a lot of different explanations out of the White House, including on NBC News, Donald Trump saying that it was in part because he didn't think the Russia thing merited investigation by the FBI.
I think it, you know, I would guess that, you know, as I, and I've talked to a couple of my, only a couple, because again, we've been out of session of my colleagues since last Wednesday. They were just as surprised as I was. Was there cause to do this? Not based on the evidence that I saw. We did know that he was, again, on shaky grounds with, you know, the hardcore on both sides of the aisle, and is able, as commander-in-chief, to pull the trigger. Was it right? No, I don't. Especially the timing of it, you know, when literally it's the night before he's meeting with the Russian foreign minister, Mr. Lavrov. I mean, how did someone not connect the dots as to how this story was going to be played out? So, you know, you can see that I clearly don't have a seat at the table down at 1600 Pennsylvania.
Can you believe, though, two things here concurrently, which may seem to be in conflict, which is one, that maybe James Comey was not the best person to be running the FBI, but at the same time, that when there is an investigation ongoing, which involves maybe the president, although he insists not him, but it's certainly some people who are in his campaign at the time, and maybe people now working in the White House, that's not the time for someone at the FBI to be fired.
This is why we need to get to the bottom of this whole Russian thing. And, you know, and take the trail to where it leads us. And again, if the House and Senate Intelligence Committees are unable to together come up with a report that makes sense and they have a history of working together on the interests of the country. Certainly Mike Rogers did that. Pete Hoekstra, when he was chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, had a wonderful relationship with his ranking member. I want to say it was Jane Harman from California, a Democrat. Mike Rogers had the same relationship with Dutch Ruppersberger, from a Democrat from Baltimore. And again, Warner and Richard Burr have that same relationship in the Senate. So if they're unable to do it, and now this is obviously more questions to ask, more answers that need to follow, you know, we'll see where it takes us.
This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. We are speaking with West Michigan Congressman Fred Upton. And again, just to clarify, we're speaking Friday afternoon. Yeah. If anything happened
Who
over
knows?
The weekend, that is why we didn't get to it. You told us that on the health care bill, not us in particular, but the public at large, that going into the vote, you were someone who could not support what the Republicans had put forward. You eventually cast one of the crucial votes to get it passed, largely because of an amendment regarding high-risk pools. Explain why this was crucial
to getting your
vote. So
here's what happened. So I laid out a whole series of principles that I wanted to follow as related to repeal and replacing Obamacare. And I think you and I had talked earlier in the year, and I came out against just repeal without knowing what that replacement piece was going to be like, and used the line, I don't believe in the trust us we'll get it right, you know. So I said we needed to see what that was. And for me, I had a number of principles. Kids, young adults under 26 staying on their parents' policies. Make sure that there's no cap on insurance so that folks all of a sudden would hit that cap and they wouldn't have insurance. Wanted to work with the governors and did on those with those 31 states that expanded Medicaid, Michigan being one of them. And a devout vow on making sure that folks with pre-existing illnesses are covered and not discriminated against, and would make the comment that of, you know, we were tagged with, I don't know, I sort of joke, 20 million votes in the last couple of Congresses on repealing Obamacare. I think it was like 50 was the last number. But in all of those principles that I just laid out stayed. Maybe not the expansion, but certainly on pre-existing illnesses, they were never threatened. So there was a late amendment that the Rules Committee allowed to be made part of the bill that was offered by Mr. MacArthur, and it allows for states to seek a waiver to get a waiver so that they don't have to provide essential health benefits as part of the package, which includes pre-existing illnesses. I didn't like the amendment, and the president himself said on over the weekend, this is now 2 weekends ago, said, I'm going to make sure, I'm paraphrasing here, I'm going to make sure that the pre-existing illness protections are just as strong in this bill as they were in Obamacare. One sentence statement. But with this amendment, which allows the states to waive it, it's not true anymore. So I was, you know, asking the question a bunch of times, and I finally said, you know what, I can't support this the way that it is, because that violates one of the principles that I laid out. So I let our leadership know. I said, you know, I can't vote. I'm not going to vote for this. And they came back to me. Trump called me and made the little joke about using the window instead of the phone. Yeah, but right. We had a pretty rough conversation. And I never really met him until March. I shook his hand when he gave the State of the Union address back in February, I guess it was. But I never really sat down with him until March in small meetings. He's a pretty gruff guy. And he was pretty tough on me. And I used some colorful language. And, you know,
imagine.
I gave him the razz right back. I didn't use the same language, but I was, you know, but I told him that the bottom line was, I said, Mr. President, and I read him his statement. I said, here's what you said just a couple days ago. I support what you said. This bill doesn't allow for it. And I said, I just can't do it. And we agreed to hang up, and we did and moved on. And he had the same conversation then with one of my colleagues, Billy Long. He was from Missouri. He was the very first colleague to endorse Trump, 2015. They were best of buddies. They did a lot of things together. And Billy's on the Energy and Commerce Committee with me. And about 7 o'clock that night, I talked to the president. It was about 4:00. So about 7 o'clock, the president calls Billy, and he goes, and Billy's got the same view I do. And he's, and Billy's, you know, I wasn't part of the conversation, but Billy relates to me. But Billy said, no, I'm in the same position Upton is. So what is the fix? So I went and drafted an amendment, and it provides $8 billion for new high-risk pools to cover those individuals in a state that might seek a waiver to get out from underneath the pre-existing illnesses. We believe that it's more than enough money to cover any state that does it. I know that Michigan is not going to seek that waiver. I've had that conversation with Rick Snyder, our governor. I've had that conversation with John Kasich, the governor of Ohio, Chris Christie, governor of New Jersey. They're not going to do that. But you may have a couple of states, maybe a handful. And I want to make sure those people are covered. So
there could also be new governors in those states.
Could be new governors.
I mean, certainly will at some point.
That's right. Absolutely. Well, of course, we have to have a new governor beginning in 2019 here in Michigan because of term limits. But the bottom line, too, is so we think that we have the more than enough money. And as I said, if it's not, I'll be the first in line and I'll get a bunch of folks to join with me to make sure that we have enough to cover this. Now, again, this is in the House.
Is that as strong as Obamacare? With the money for high risk pools, it's as strong a protection against losing insurance for pre-existing conditions.
So actually, you asked a different question. You ended up with a different question than I thought. But actually, the money that we have is more than the money that Obamacare initially had to set up high risk pools for all 50 states, knowing that in fact we might have just a handful that may seek that. But yes, to answer your second question or the question that you really asked, yes, I think that protections are equally as strong. And one of the things that I hope that the Senate can do as they start is that they will underscore what we did and to make that very distinct and clear that folks with pre-existing conditions are not going to be discriminated against.
Doesn't it also depend on how many states do seek waivers? You know, as the New York Times said, if one state seeks a waiver, well, that $8 billion should be fine. If you get more than that or a lot more than that, that changes the calculation.
Yeah, and it depends. Is it going to be a small state like Hawaii or is it going to be a big state like California? Now, but tell me, do you think... So let's use California. Jerry Brown, the governor for life in California, is he ever... going to ask that essential health benefits be removed from the state of California? I don't think so.
How about Texas?
Texas, I don't know. It's a big state too, not as big as California. But again, if it's not enough, then we need to come back with more. But now the Senate has started this process. Will they include an amendment like MacArthur's in the bill? I suspect not. Don't know. I mean, we'll see. Time will tell. They're going to take a month or two. I'd like to think that I have a chance of being on the conference committee between the House and the Senate. And their bill is going to be different. Their focus is a good one. I read this last week now that their focus is going to be on reducing premiums. That's a good thing because one of the things why we want to act on fixing Obamacare is that there are a lot of reports out that premiums are going to jump by 40 or 50% come this fall. We don't want that to happen.
Could you vote for the bill that passed the House on final passage? If it was not going over to the Senate to be amended, if it came back clean, could you vote for it on final passage to send it to President Trump for his signature?
Don't ask me today. The answer is, you know, this is part of the process. I am convinced that the Senate will have it. They're not going to take up the House passed bill. They're gonna start from scratch. They've already started the last week, so that's really it's not gonna happen. It's they're gonna have a different bill. No, even hypothetically, it's not. They've already made the move.
Hypothetically, this bill good enough for you that it would be? You know,
no,
as Justin Amash said.
I want to see it. I don't know what Justin said, but I want to see it.
He said
it was.
He said he voted for it because it was somewhat of an improvement over the Affordable Care Act, although he wasn't crazy about it.
Yeah, well, I'm not jumping down up and down about it. That's for sure. But I also think that the Senate, by watching us and you know the process, you know that we don't have a CBO score. I want to see a final CBO score, but and I called for it before we get to the final page or the final.
Why not have a CBO score before this vote?
Well, we tried to get one, and don't ask me why we didn't have one. We did our bill. The bill passed out of committee in March. I mean, CBO is a pretty large agency, hundreds of people that work there. And we all thought we'd have a CBO score, and we didn't have one. We still don't have one today as this show airs, and they tell us that it's still 2 weeks away. We'll have one before it's said and done, and probably and certainly have one, I think, as the Senate bill begins to move. But again, their bill is going to be different. But yeah, the bottom line is we need it before we get to the final day, before we get to the final vote.
Previously, the Congressional Budget Office had said under an earlier proposal that 24 million people would lose insurance coverage by 2026. Is that an acceptable number to you when this comes back for a final vote?
No, it's not. I want to see us have premiums stabilized or going down versus a 40 to 50% hike. You know, just this last week now, both Humana and Aetna dropped out of the individual market altogether. They said, we can't make it, and they pulled out of whole states.
Out of the healthcare exchanges.
Correct.
Right.
So, you know, we, Michigan, our rate went up last year only 17%. That was pretty good compared to the rest of the states. Arizona was over 100%. But if you come to folks who are relying on this come this fall, you know, it comes out, the rates come out in end of October and say it's going to be a 40 or 50% increase, and already there are reports that it will be, that is not acceptable answer. So I had this last week, I spoke to a group and someone said, well, and he was a Republican. It was not a Republican gathering. It was an event in a township. He said, why don't you just let it go down? Why don't you just let Obamacare just, you know, collapse altogether? And, you know, you all Republicans can just take a walk and say, we told you so. And I said, well, we can't, because we know that the program is rife with problems. A member was sold that you could keep your plan if you liked it. Didn't happen. Premiums would go down. Didn't happen. And we know it's going to get worse. So what can we do to try and fix it and keep some of the principles that I outlined earlier?
But if the future health care bill is going to keep all the promises President Trump has made,
well,
I mean, is that possible? I mean, better coverage, cheaper. You know, I don't
that's
have the
a good
exact
goal.
One in front
yep,
of me.
That's a good goal for us to try and get to. And you know what? I do think that the Senate bill can do more for reducing premiums or putting more downward pressure on premium increases than the House bill did. And that'll be a plus. And I'll support that Senate proposal as we get to conference. And again, if I can be on the conference committee, that's the approach that I would take.
You mentioned earlier Medicaid expansion. There is kind of a phase out here of the federal money for Medicaid expansion. So what happens to that down the road?
So again, I think the Senate, so remember, 31 states were like Michigan. Ohio was, Indiana under Governor Pence expanded, Illinois, New Jersey, Texas did not, California did, Florida did not, New York did. 31 states were like ours. So what we did, and we had to fight back some of our colleagues that wanted to have it end literally this week. You know, just wasn't supposed to happen. Remember, this all started because the feds provided 100% of the cost to the states. Medicaid, when it first started, you know, in the 60s, was in essence pretty much a 50-50 system. States would do 50%, they would manage it, feds would pay 50%. It's changed now. Michigan, we're 63%, West Virginia is 73%, Illinois still is 50-50. So it's all different for a variety of reasons. I think we need to look at that, but it's another subject. So what Obamacare did was, it said, well, the federal government will pay 100%, so there was a real inducement carrot to get states to do that. And then they'll phase it down to 90% by 2020. And for Michigan, we took in, you know, under Governor Snyder, through a Republican legislature, they expanded by hundreds of thousands of people, Medicaid, up to 138% of the poverty level. So in essence, from 100% to 138%, hundreds of thousands of people in that universe. What the House bill did, and I thought it was fair, was that it continues that for those 31 states until 2020, so another couple years. And then that universe of folks that are benefiting from that Medicaid expansion are grandfathered, and they, and not until they go off for other reasons, do they turn 65 and get into Medicare? Did they move out of state? You know, whatever the reason is, they're protected as long as they're up within 138% of the poverty level. So as you look at the Senate, 31 states, how many senators is that? 62. So my sense is that the Senate bill will have a better cushion, better transition period than even the House, knowing that they too are likely to be able to defeat the amendments offered by someone from a state that didn't expand who would like it to end this week. So as you look to the future, I think the Senate bill will do more for Michigan on Medicaid expansion. And there are some other things that we need to look at as well. You know, I'm very involved in the fight against opioid abuse. Had a, you know, sat down with some of the team. Chris Christie is the head of that. President Trump named him a few weeks ago. We had a bipartisan meeting a couple weeks ago. We're going to have some more. A lot of that Medicaid money goes for treatment for people wanting to get off. You know, I was, I've been to a number of our community health centers recently, this last month in April. Great new facilities, and one of the things that they've really focused on is mental health and opioid abuse. We want to make sure that we don't cut that off. So I think there's some ideas that we might be able to work on this as it relates to the Medicaid expansion.
Okay. I always like to talk policy before we get to the politics stuff, especially when there's so much policy going on. But
it's a very, you've done a great job.
Well, thank you.
And I hope our listeners are still with us.
Let's hope so. But let me ask you this. Do you plan to run for United States Senate next
year? Oh, my goodness. I didn't know that's where you're going to go. You know, we've not made any decisions. I am flattered that a number of folks from not only Michigan but around the country have tried to encourage me to think about this. And at some point, we will for sure.
But make a decision.
Yeah, but we're not anywhere close to making a decision. I mean, I've been totally immersed, not only chairing the Energy Subcommittee, but obviously involved on the Obamacare. You know, trying to fix it as we've talked about the last number of minutes. I'll tell you this story too. You know, when I first ran for the House. This had never been a dream of mine to run for the House. I had the great opportunity of serving at the White House, met my wife while I worked there, married, had two really good black labs, Wrigley and Gammon. And I got a call from friends of mine. I'd been active in political campaigns. I got calls from leaders in the Twin Cities, St. Joe, Benton Harbor, saying, asking me to run. And I said, you know, it's not a dream. I'm happy. I'm saluting the Marine Guard. I'm meeting with the president every week. Da-da-da-da. No. Answer's no. They came back to me a couple months later, and I said we'd think about it, and we came back to test the waters. And as it turned out, I beat the only incumbent to lose in the country in a primary. I never thought we'd be in the majority. I never thought I'd be on the Energy and Commerce Committee, let alone chair it, you know, do things like 21st Century Cures and pull things together. And that's sort of where we are now. I've never had a dream to run for the Senate.
But you are considering it at least
We will be taking a look at it, but we're not anywhere close to making a decision.
And have you put any sort of timetable on it?
No.
I want to make a decision one way or another by such and such a date.
Nope, haven't.
West Michigan Congressman Fred Upton, as always, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
The interview with Congressman Fred Upton was recorded Friday afternoon. On Thursday's West Southwest, we'll sit down with the man who will become president of Western Michigan University this summer. Edward Montgomery will succeed John Dunn, who is retiring after 10 years leading the university. Montgomery becomes Western's ninth president on August 1st. We'll hear from him on Thursday. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.